Blog Talk Radio.
Start the clock. Good afternoon. At the tone, time will be real time.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Let's Change the World. The Let's Change the World weekly talk radio show is a product of the Let's Change the World movement. The movement is all about everybody doing whatever little bit we can, no matter how small it is, to positively impact the world we live in or our communities. And if we all do whatever little bit we can, remember, no matter how small it is, we can make a difference. We can move things. We can change things. We can make life better for other people. And we all need a better life. I think you'll all agree. To learn more about the movement, you can visit the Change the World blog. That's www.thechangetheworldmovement.com. www.thechangetheworldmovement.com. Usually we're joined by my wonderful radio wife and co-host, Cheryl Alisa. She's having some personal difficulties today, nothing to be concerned about, nothing to worry about, but she won't be with us today. I'll be riding solo, so I'm going to need your help out there to help me out, you know, call in with your questions, your concerns, your comments, what have you, and keep me company. Otherwise, I'm going to be sad and lonely. I'm going to be all by myself. So we're going to have a very interesting show, very educational today. You know, we're all about education, and it's the truth about Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. There's a whole lot out there about both of these people. They're both candidates for the presidency of the United States. The election is November the 8th, so we're getting real close. It's time to start making a decision, a final decision, as far as who you're going to vote for, or rather to vote or not. We're going to talk about that as well. I happen to believe voting is very important. A lot of people disagree with me. We're going to tackle that issue. We're going to also tackle some of the issues that are most important to you guys out there, and rather voting for one candidate or the other will make a difference with those issues in your lives, okay? And we've got a special guest today on our Books and Music to Change the World segment, which is coming right up, and this lady I recently met, and I'm so inspired by her and the book that she wrote, and I'm going to bring her on in just a second, and her name is Dawn Croy, and she wrote a book that's entitled Darkness Before the Dawn. If you want to think about that title for a minute, Darkness Before the Dawn. It's a very interesting title. It brings up some automatic thoughts in your head, but we're going to bring her on. The chat room is open. If anybody wants to chat, I'll also be trying to work the chat room while we have the show. You know, I'll be by myself again, so it's going to be a little bit difficult. But if you're scared to come on the air, if you're a little bit shy, you can chat, and I will raise your questions, comments, or concerns on the air and respond to them. Or someone else can call in and respond too. So without further ado, let's bring on our special guest today. And I see we've got several people from her area code, and make sure I've got the right phone number here. For sure I do. Okay, so from the 678, I'm going to bring on our special guest, Dawn Croy. Dawn, are you out there?
I sure am.
Hey, I had several members. Evidently, you've done some promoting. You got some other callers from the 678 calling in, so I had to figure out which one was you. How are
That's all right. I'm doing well tonight. How about yourself?
Wonderful. It's a beautiful day in South Florida, and where are you at?
I am in Georgia. We're in Noonan, and it's good fall weather here. I'm happy to see it.
All right. I missed the fall. I'm from Ohio originally, and everybody's like down here in Florida. They just hug themselves when I say Ohio. They go, oh, they think it's freezing all year round, like it's Antarctica or something. It's not. You know, we've got four seasons, and I don't miss the winter in Ohio, but I definitely miss the fall, summer, and the spring. Beautiful.
I agree. I moved here from Wyoming when I was 16, so people hear Wyoming and they think the same thing, that it's just cold all year round, but it has seasons, so...
Yeah, they think that you live, you came from Antarctica or something.
I agree.
So, Don, you wrote a book, and what's the title of your book again? And tell us a little bit, tell us something about it.
Okay, the title of my book is entitled Darkness Before the Dawn, and it is probably a little bit of an uncomfortable first-person perspective of what it's like to live through an abusive relationship. In my case, it was an abusive marriage to which I had to get myself and three children through.
Wow. Now, what type of abuse are we talking about? Because there's several different types. You got mental, you know, go ahead.
It kind of hit on all of them. You know, it started with the mental and psychological and emotional and worked its way up through the financial control and the finally ending with the physical and sexual abuse.
So in most of these cases, is it because a lot of people wonder, how do you get involved in these types of relationships if you've never been in one? Is it a gradual escalation, or is it something that you should have been able to recognize right off the bat but failed to for some reason? Maybe love makes you blind, they always say.
If I had listened to my inner feelings, my gut, I would, because I was never 100% comfortable with this person. I married him because I felt like that's what was expected of me. But it was definitely gradual. Like, with abusers and somebody with an abusive mentality, they know that if they start off by slapping you, then you're just going to walk away. And it's a gradual entrenchment. You know, when it gets to the point of the physical abuse and the sexual abuse, you feel like you deserve it because they have worked you into that mindset that this is no better than what you deserve. They have completely and totally broken down your self-esteem and your self-image, and it makes you question everything that you think, because everything that you do, everything that you think, is it me? It's a constant cycle of trying to be better. Well, maybe if I just do this, then he'll be happy or she'll be happy. And you blame yourself for things that are not your fault. So it really just blows my mind.
So when you say that you felt that it was something you had to do to enter into a relationship or to marry this gentleman, what did you mean by that?
I mean that there was some part of me that was not wholly comfortable, but this person was older than me by a significant amount, which should have been a tip-off. But he was somebody that was well-respected in the community, well-respected in my family circle of friends, and it was the classic case of his ex-wife cheated on him. She was a horrible person, turning his daughters against him. Yeah, I mean, it was a classic buildup of poor, pitiful me. And so I was 18 years old. I had never been with a man before. And so a lot of this stuff was completely new to me. Like, I thought, well, I guess this is just what I have to endure. This is what I have to deal with. Not having been in a lot of relationships, we moved around a lot when I was a kid. I think the longest I'd ever had a boyfriend before that was about 6 or 7 months because we moved. And so it was like, well, maybe this is what I should expect. And some of the things that went on were embarrassing and humiliating. You don't want to talk to anybody about it because they're going to think you're crazy, or they're going to just oh, well, no, that can't be it. That has to be just your perception. Like, you really get caught up in the feeling of, if I say anything to anybody that knows us both, one, it's going to get back to them. Two, they're not going to believe me. And so maybe I am just crazy. And that's where
so
it starts.
So your family and all of your friends and everybody, while this relationship is going on, they looked at you too how? Did they look at you as a beautiful couple, or did any of them suspect anything was going on?
He could behave himself very well in public. No one would ever have believed that he had an anger management problem, or that he was the kind of person who would come home and be angry over the fact that his sick pregnant wife would have ordered pizza because she'd had a stomach flu for 4 or 5 days and just wasn't up to cooking, and throw a dining room chair at her, thus ending that pregnancy. So I just thought that one. Well, the doctors don't know why I miscarried that baby, although I could have quite easily told you why.
Wow. So
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I'm just very intrigued. I'm gonna stay with you for a while because this is a great conversation. So, how did he start out? Was he a romantic type of guy, or was he? How did he start and escalate? What came first? What came second?
Well, it was when I first met him. He was my martial arts instructor. And he was a very outgoing, dedicated, honorable, upstanding, gentlemanly person. He opened doors. He was polite. He was friendly. He was helpful. He got along great with my dad and my mom, because my mom was in class with me. And this was all that we saw of him, was this public persona. And then when we got married, we went to...
So you fell in love with him, or did you marry him because
the more I think about it, there was some part of me that felt like if I didn't marry him, then I was never going to get married. I don't know why I thought that, honestly. I guess because I hadn't had a lot of relationships, and I was not a girly girl. I was more of a tomboy. I was not easy. I was a virgin when I got married, and that was a turnoff for a lot of guys, you know, in high school. And like I said, I was 18 years old. I honestly didn't know any better. But I felt there was a lot of
pressure. And then
was
there pressure from your family and everything? The family, they were like, you need to go ahead and marry this guy. He's successful. He's treating you nice. You need to go ahead and do this.
Yeah. Not so much necessarily from my parents, but definitely from my social circle. Oh, he's a great guy. He's got a job. He's got a house. He's got his stuff together, you know. And then, of course, there was a lot of pressure for him. The wedding date got moved up several times because, oh, I just can't wait to be married to you. And
so he was a great guy until you got married.
Kind of. And then, like, on our way home, we went and got married in Chattanooga at the Hamilton County Courthouse with my parents and my best friend from high school and her boyfriend. And it may sound funny because, I mean, it kind of was ironic, but, I looked at him and I said, well, I love you. And he said, well, God, I hope so. And, like,
wow.
The look of shock on my face, he started laughing at me. He's like, oh, look at you, you know. But that in and of itself, I guess, should have been kind of a tip to how this was going to go. I had several, like, part-time, temporary kind of jobs. I babysat. I did some side contract work for the construction company that he worked for. But I never had my own money, and it was always his money. And even though I got all of his finances sorted out and got his financial plan back on track and was taking care of his girls and I was a stay-at-home mom when I was 19 and a half. I had a newborn and an 11 and 13-year-old girl at home. And I was running this household as best as I could. I never had a car in my name. And every time that I liked a vehicle, suddenly it would be gone. And it would be replaced by something else. I never had a new car. We didn't get a new vehicle until my youngest son was like 3 or 4. And even that, it was in his name. I still have the first car that I had that was in my name. I have had it for 9 years. And there is a part of me that even though it has 252,000 miles on it, is loath to get rid of it. And I think a lot of that is because of the attachment that that was the car in my name. It was mine. And nobody could take that away from me because it was mine. But the house was never in my name. Nothing was ever
in my name.
So
part of the control factor is, in some of these cases at least, is that the abuser doesn't allow you to have any control over anything. They want to control everything. That way it's hard for you to leave and probably brings down your self-esteem at the same time.
Completely, because I was completely under his control. There was nothing I could do. And he even got to the point.
So what started happening?
Honestly, he was the kind of person, and I started noticing it when my oldest son was just a few weeks old. He was a colicky kind of baby. He ingested a lot of air when he ate. And so he cried because his belly hurt, which made him swallow more air, which made his stomach hurt worse. So he cried more. It was just a cycle with him. And I would be up with that child for 20, 22 hours straight. I was not getting any rest at all. And one morning he came out when my son was 2 weeks old. And he looked at my child who had finally fallen asleep. I was in the recliner. He was laying on my chest and he was finally asleep. He went, well, at least somebody got some sleep. That damn kid knew I had to go to work. And so he kept me up all night. And I was just shocked.
Wow.
And I looked at him. I said, he's 2 weeks old. He has no concept of day, night, or somebody going to work, or what that even means.
Right.
But that he could have such anger for a small child.
Wow.
An infant.
That's crazy.
A newborn. It blew
That's
my
crazy.
Mind. And, I mean, he wasn't
so
the
then,
type. He never stayed in the hospital with me. He would be there while I was in labor, and he can say that he cut the umbilical cord for all three children, but he left right afterwards. So, like, with my oldest son, there I was, 19 years old, with a newborn in the hospital, and I was by myself. I was completely alone. Nobody was there with me during the night.
So the beginning was kind of like, sounds like more of a mental type of abuse.
Yes, definitely. It absolutely was. And then, I mean, he would make comments like, you were so smart before I married you. I guess I just sucked your brains out. Comments like that. Just very demeaning. Constantly questioning my intelligence, constantly putting me down because of my age. I honestly had never seen my virginity as a bad thing until him because... Oh, yeah, well, what would you know? I'm the only guy you've ever been with. Like, that was an insult. He would insult me over that. Something that he should have taken as a gift, he absolutely made fun of me over. Like, I wasn't good enough.
So then it turned into a lot of verbal abuse.
Oh, yes. He would do things like and everybody has days like this where it... Like, there are 5 kids and 2 dogs in this house, and my husband and I both work. And most of the time I get home before Mike does. But, like, he'll walk in, and I just look at him like, okay, I need some help because I'm about to lose my freaking mind. I've got kids all over the place. These two are arguing. The dog is trying to chew up the sofa. I need help. And so I'm not necessarily the happy, bubbly person that when you walk through the door, maybe you want to see. And that's, mm-hmm. you know, everybody has days like that. But God forbid that I should not be the happy, bubbly person, because he would open the door, and if I wasn't all smiles and sunshine, he would literally back out the door, slam the door, wait a few seconds, open the door, and go, you ready to try this again?
Wow. Really?
Yeah. It was just, it was like, okay, I'm glad that you're home, I guess, but I don't have to be, this is not 1952. I am not the woman on that commercial for the washing machine, and
yeah.
you're just going to have to deal with that. There are children all over the place. That one's had diarrhea all day. This one's been picking on his brother. What do you want me to do? You know, or
and
if
so,
I called with a problem during the day, well, what the hell do you want me to do? I'm at work. You deal with it. Okay, yay. Thanks for the emotional support there. So.
Wow. I can hear you kind of the pain rehashing in your mind as you're talking.
It's much,
does it
much
ever
easier.
Go away?
It does, and it's much easier to talk about now than it was a few years ago. And honestly, when I was writing the book a couple of years ago, it was very hard. It was extremely difficult because there was a significant portion of my life that I was completely suicidal. I had so many different plans, and it was by through just God's grace. I would hear my children then go, well, if I'm not in the picture, then who's going to save them? And so I would write a chapter, and then I may not be able to pick up the computer and continue to write for weeks because it was so painful to bring all this back up again and relive it through words.
Yeah, I wrote a book myself, and it was the same the pain that I went through back then. You have to relive it in detail because you have to put all those details into the book and you just
mm-hmm.
rehash it over and over again. I know what you mean. And so how did this relationship come to a conclusion?
It came to a conclusion when I, honestly, of all the most ironic things, I had known this woman for 3 or 4 years, and she had talked me into going to nursing school with her. And I discovered that they were having an affair and had been having an affair for quite a while I was in nursing school with her. And that, of all things, was my line in the sand. That was my, okay, even God says that I don't have to deal with this.
How can people be so bold? I never understood how people could be so bold that they can have a relationship with your spouse and grin and smile in your face and act like your best friends.
I know, and the worst part of it, in a way, was that she was my confidant. I would confide in her things that were happening to me at home, and she would just go right back behind me and stab me in the back and tell him, which is why the abuse got progressively worse with this woman.
How long had they been having an affair?
Probably since they met. Honestly, I met her through him. And he's like, oh, she's this great person. We've got kids about the same age. You should totally talk to her. And, you know, her husband was accusing her of having an affair, but he was
so
a very jealous person.
So he introduced her to you.
So I just wrote it off. Yeah.
So they could have been having an affair. And then he introduced.
Long before I met her, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well,
so when I quit talking to her after that because I'm like, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. And I didn't tell anybody. I completely bottled this up and just kept it inside myself because I'm not that person.
So did you, how did you find out?
Oh, the irony. Well, he tried to force me into a threesome with them, and I ruined the entire thing because I locked myself in the bathroom crying. Okay, that was tip-off number one. And then he, oh, I'm going to end it, blah, 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 blah. This is not. And then he didn't come home until very, very late one night, and he didn't come to bed, which was unusual, but it was a nice break. And I found a note on his pillow, oh, I love you so much, et cetera, and so forth, which at this point just set off alarm bells, like, okay, what have you been doing? And he went to kiss me, and he had a mustache, and I smelled something, you know, kind of female, if you get my drift. And I said, then you went and you were with her last night, weren't you? And he said, yes, I was. And I said, I'm done. I'm not doing this anymore. And I told him right then, I said, I'm done with nursing school. You're moving out. I can't do this. And that was in October of 2006. I said, I'm done. And I went on to clinicals and just kind of, I could have ruined, I could have gotten her kicked out of nursing school. I could have ruined her career as being a nurse due to ethics and morals, et cetera, and so forth. But I didn't, because I didn't want, I'm not going to do that to anybody. You know, if you fail, let that be on you. I'm not going to be the cause of that. And I honestly did not say anything to anybody until we were doing our mental health portion of nursing school. And one of my friends, who was pregnant at the time, she was like, hey, come on, let's go to Brewster's and get ice cream, because I told her I'd never been to Brewster's. I was like, okay, sure, why not? So I rode with her, and we went, and we got our ice cream, and she sat down and put the keys in her pocket, and she said, and now you're not going anywhere until you tell me what the hell is going on. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, you know very well what I mean. What is going on? And so I gave her the abbreviated version. And she went, you're a better woman than I am, because I would have thrown all of his shit out and her shit out, because she was living in my mom's guest cabin free of rent because she had
what?
Through a divorce, yes. She was, I was watching her kids while I was trying to do homework because she couldn't focus with her kids. I was feeding her children.
God.
I was
helping
support
her. How can you handle that type
her?
Of betrayal? It's hurting me just to listen to it. How can you handle that type of betrayal? You are a better person
because
than a lot of people.
I'm not. I there is no way. Okay, yeah, I could have gotten her kicked out, but I'm not going to throw anybody's children out in the street with nowhere to go. And I refused to make the children of my father look bad to them. My youngest son was 5 when we divorced. And
you know what? I can
kind of
relate
mother,
to that kind of a. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you just struck a nerve because I can relate to that because I've been in an abusive relationship myself, and a lot of people kind of smirk when I tell them that, you know, a woman
it
was abusing you, yeah, right, type of thing. But it was her and her 2-year-old daughter were living with me.
Mm-hmm.
She was very abusive. I mean, because I'm not a woman beater, so what she
mm-hmm.
would do is do things to me, like one time she threw a cup and it hit me in my face, and one time she actually lunged out, bit me in my face, stuff like that. And I'm not the type to sit there and take it, but she had a 2-year-old daughter who I loved, and she,
mm-hmm.
they didn't have anywhere to go, so I took it for quite a while simply because I didn't want to put them out on the street because of the 2-year-old.
Right. Right.
You know what I mean?
And
so I made her – go ahead. I don't want to take over the story, but you struck on her.
Yeah. No, I completely understand. And for people that think that it's only women and children who can be abused, they're absolutely wrong. Women can be very abusive and manipulative and emotionally controlling. And I'm sorry, but there are a lot of women that are just straight-up mean. But, I mean, as far as he went – there was no way that I was going to make him look bad to his sons. They had seen
yeah.
more than enough. I have multiple broken bones. I've had multiple surgeries to fix my abdominal muscles from putting myself between him and them. So it wasn't...
Wow.
It wasn't a surprise. It wasn't a shock. Thank God my younger two were too young to remember it. My oldest one was not that lucky. He's 4 years older than my youngest. And he caught the brunt of it because him and his father never saw eye to eye. And I was constantly coming between the two of them because he'd just go after him for no reason. And so I didn't, because that was their father.
This just sounds like an awesome story. I'm getting short on time because we actually have another topic that we have to cover.
But I want to make sure that this sounds just like and this is all your story in the book.
Yes.
This sounds like an awesome story. It's a story that a lot of people can relate to. There might be people out there right now listening or who will listen to the archive later who are mm-hmm. going through something similar. What would you say to them?
Right. What I would say to them is don't feel alone. As isolated as you feel, as lonely as a place that is, you are not alone. And there are thousands of people who go through this every day. There are so many places out there to help. There are so many shelters and hotlines and people. Don't be ashamed. And that's a huge thing, is you feel so much shame and guilt that this is your fault. It's not. There is nobody out there who deserves what I went through. There is nobody out there who deserves what my children went through. There is nobody out there who deserves to get hit.
And
reach out.
Will your
Find
book
will your book
be a help for them? Or
yes, I absolutely think that it will. That's why I wrote it. I wrote it because I knew I was a home health nurse, and there were so many women who would tell me about things that they were going through and tell me about what they had gone through, or they had seen their sister or their mother or their aunt or a cousin. And I realized there's a huge network of us out there who are so ashamed of what we went through that we don't talk about it. And you have to. And you have to understand that how you're feeling is normal. I went finally to a therapist through the urging of my mother because I would have blackouts where I would just lose huge chunks of my day. And I walked to my mother and I said, I am losing my mind. I am going crazy. I don't know what's wrong with me. And she said, you need to talk to somebody. And so I spent 2 hours talking to this psychiatrist, sobbing my heart out. It was the first time that I had ever talked to anybody and told anybody what I had gone through. I told my mom bits and pieces, and she sat right there next to me holding my hand. And the first thing that this man looked at me and said was, I would think that there would be something wrong with you if you weren't feeling this way. What you are feeling and what you are experiencing is normal.
Yeah.
And to be told that what I was in that moment was normal made me feel so much better, because I had not felt normal. My expectation of normal, my expectation of who I should be. And you have to understand, you're never going to go back to the person that you were before you went through this. You have to find your new normal and work your way up from there.
And then writing this book was probably therapeutic in a way, too, to get it out there.
It was.
I know when I wrote mine, it was very therapeutic for some of the things I have went through. Where can, one place they're going to be able to find information about your book and a link to purchase it will be on the Change the World blog. You're going to have a permanent posting on the Change the World blog, because I believe your book will help people. So it fits right in. And where else can people find your book right now?
You can find me on Amazon. You can find me at Books A Million and Barnes & Noble. Anybody who would like an autographed copy, I have some at my house. If you want to find me on Facebook, I am author Dawn Miller. I have a page there. You can message me or send me a message at Dawn Croise. That's K-R-O-I-S is my last name. Search for me. You might be able to find me. And send me a message and give me your address, and I would be more than happy to write you a personal message and send you a book.
So your actual pen name or your author name is Dawn Miller?
Yes.
Okay. That's important for people to know if they go to
Amazon
or Barnes & Noble or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's author Dawn Miller if you want to look her up. And what's the name of the book again?
Darkness Before the Dawn.
Darkness Before the Dawn, you guys. Find it on the Change the World blog. Find it on BarnesandNoble.com, Amazon.com. Author Dawn Miller. This is, I believe, has to be a wonderful story. I haven't read it yet.
But just from listening to your story here on the show, I know it's just a wonderful book. It's going to help somebody out there too. Sometimes you have to read somebody else's story in order to understand what's going on in your own personal story. You know what I mean? In your own personal life. And once you read somebody else's story, you can look at yourself and say, wait a minute. Now I see what's happening here. I do need to get out of this or get help or talk to somebody about it or something. So it's very important that you guys pick up this book. And I appreciate you coming on the show so much. You're absolutely welcome to hang out if you want to. You don't have to, of course. You may have things to do. But we're going to move into our the actual topic of the show now. But thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. It has been a pleasure.
Absolutely, absolutely. And everybody out there, we're going to move into our actual topic now. Anybody can call in with questions, comments, concerns, what have you, rather it be about our topic or if you want to continue the conversation about domestic violence and things of that nature or her book, feel free to dial number one. Dial number one and you're on the air. I'm going to bring you on. The topic of the show, which is the truth about Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Let's move into that a little bit because it's election time. And a lot of people feel that it's not important to be involved in the presidential election or any election for that matter. A lot of people feel it's not important to vote. So this show is all about education. So I'm going to begin with just a little bit of education for those who really don't understand how things work. A lot of things that you want to see change in your community, regardless of what it is. Maybe you feel like the streets have potholes and you need them to be fixed. Maybe you feel like your schools in your neighborhood are terrible. Maybe you feel like there's too much stopping and frisking, and maybe the police are racial profiling in your community. Maybe you feel like there's too much violence in your community. It doesn't matter what it is. The primary way to get these things changed is through the political process. The reason is because the system in the United States is designed to be run by the people. Now, who those people are depends on who participates. So a lot of people, for example, black people in their communities, they say that, hey, you know, the police department, they're treating the black people in our community terribly. You know what I mean? There's no justice in our community. You know, they're stopping and frisking us, racially profiling us. They're, you know, the police brutality is terrible. The police are killing people, whatever. And so some people feel the solution is that this is a black community. Why aren't there more black people on the police force? Why is the chief of police a white person? Why is the mayor of this mostly black city a white person? Maybe things would be better if the people who ran the police department or the city were people of color or who understood the community and who actually had a vested interest in the community versus somebody who lives in the suburbs who comes to work in your community and runs things. Well, how do you change that? Well, you have to participate in the political process. You have to vote. You have to petition. You have to boycott. You have to protest. You have to understand and know the government and the laws and what you have a right to, and take advantage of those laws that benefit you. And, of course, not all laws are going to benefit you, and you have to try to change the ones that don't. And you have to change them through the political process. If you don't participate in the political process, nothing is going to change in your favor. The example that I was using, if you live in a black community and you think that community should be ran by a black person, it will not happen if the black people don't vote. Because the few white people in your community are going to vote, and they're going to vote in a white person to run the community. It's that simple. And I'm not saying that it's bad for a white person to run a black community. I'm just making a point that if you feel that that's the way things should be, or if you feel that you need someone else, rather be black or white, running the community, the only way to get someone else who you trust into that position is to vote for them. And then hopefully they will do what you expect them to do. So in this community, in this nation, the government is set up in three different sections. You have the federal government, you have the state government, and you have the local government. And the federal government has three parts. You have the judicial branch, the legislative branch, and you have the administrative branch. The administrative branch being the president. He's like the CEO of the company. He runs the company. And then you have the legislature, which makes laws. They actually make laws. President proposes laws, and the Congress or the legislative branch votes on those laws and decides whether they will become a law or not. And then the people, if they don't like the law, then they can send it to the judicial branch, who will decide if the law is constitutional or not, rather it is legal. And, of course, they have the power to overturn a law if it's not constitutional. Okay? And then you have the same thing in the state government. You have the same structure. You have the governor, and then you have the state legislature, which is the state Congress and Senate. And then you have the judicial branch on a state level. Process works exactly the same. The governor proposes laws, the legislature creates laws, the judicial branch interprets the law. Same thing on the local level. You have the mayor who proposes the laws, and then you have your city council, which is equivalent to a state or federal legislature. And they make the laws, and then you have the judicial branch on the local level as well who interprets the law. So this is how the system works. Now, on the local and the state level, every single vote counts. How do I know? Because I took the opportunity to work the last elections. And I went to school, and I became certified as a voter services technician, and my primary responsibility was to make sure that every vote got counted. And I can tell you beyond a shadow of a doubt that at least in our precinct, and now that I know the system, I know that the same system that was in our precinct is the same system they're using in every other precinct. The only way that you can cheat the system and hide votes and things like that would be for every single person in that precinct to conspire together. And the likelihood of that happening is zero, in my opinion, because none of us knew each other prior to that day. To be able to talk things over and come to this conclusion, there were people of all races. You have black people, white people, Latin people, all working together, men and women, young people, old people. We were all had something else or had very little in common to where we would come together in a short period of time and conspire together that all of us are going to cheat the system. And everybody had to put their signature on everything. So you had like 10 or 15 signatures on every single thing, and everything was sealed. And then you had a police officer, someone from the deputy's office who's there to make sure. And so the idea that the system is rigged so that your votes don't count, get that out of your head. It's ridiculous. It's just not the case. Now, the presidential in the presidential election, things are a little bit different. There's something that's called an electoral college. Now, a lot of people feel that it doesn't make sense to vote in the presidential election because of the electoral college, because they believe that every single vote doesn't count, only the electors' votes count. And so I'm going to just, you know, spread some education here on the Electoral College to begin with, and then we're going to get to the candidates. This is how the electoral process works. Okay, every state has a certain amount of congressmen assigned to their state based on the population of your state. So we have 538 federal congressmen in the United States. And those 538 congressmen break down to 2 or 3 or 5 or 10, depending on what state you live in, and based on the population of that state. Depending on how many congressmen you have for your state, which is based on the population of your state, you have exactly the same amount of electors. These are people who are appointed, who are not allowed to hold public office of any kind. Okay, do not hold public office of any kind. But they are appointed to vote in the presidential election. And they vote based on who wins the popular vote in your state. Okay? So what that means is, if you live in the state of Ohio or Florida or North Carolina or California or wherever you live, if Hillary Clinton wins that state from the popular vote, then the electors that represent your community will vote for Hillary Clinton. So the myth that your vote doesn't count in the presidential election is just that. It's just a myth, because the popular vote does matter. Because if the popular vote goes Donald Trump's way, then that elector will vote for Donald Trump. So I want to dispel the myth that they're saying that it doesn't matter if you vote or not, because the elector is going to are the votes that only count. Yes, the elector votes are the only votes that count, but they're going to vote based on the popular vote, the vote of the people, okay? And when that vote is based on every single vote being counted, okay? So it's very important for you to participate in this presidential election, because your vote will determine who that elector votes for. And if you think that it doesn't matter which president wins this election, then I beg to differ, because we're going to talk about some of the things that each one of these candidates stand for and what they intend to do when they get in office. And what they do will, down the line, impact your life. It's going to make it either better, worse, or it's going to remain the same. But however you look at it, it's going to impact it, because there's so many different issues. Now, who are these two candidates? One is Hillary Clinton. The other is Donald Trump. You've probably heard the news and you've seen a whole lot about both of them. But I'm just going to go over who both of these people are. Now, Hillary Clinton, who's been in office for about 30-plus years, she began her career, hold on just a second here. I want to make sure that I only give you the facts, because one thing about I'm going to throw some opinions in there, by the way. It's not going to all be factual, but I want to make sure I differentiate between what's fact and what is just my opinion, because I'm going to give you a lot of opinions. But right now I want to give you some facts about these candidates. The problem is that I'm trying to kill time here while I get my fact sheet pulled up here on my computer. The Blog Talk radio platform is so powerful that it slows down the studio that I work with. It slows down my computer quite a bit. Now, Hillary Rodham Clinton, so I just want to give a few facts. She was born October 26, 1947.
She's old. If she's elected, she'll be the oldest president ever elected in the United States. Same with Donald Trump. He'll be the oldest president if he's elected as well. Those are kind of helpful things to know. So she was born in 1947, and she's been in politics basically her whole life. She's been a career politician. She's always been with the Democratic Party, with the exception of a brief moment in college when she was actually a Republican. And what changed her political party was when she started to work with children, specifically black kids, and she came out and publicly stated that she can no longer be a Republican after working with because she came from a white middle-class suburban family and very little interaction with black folks as she grew up. But then when she went to college and then she started working with young minorities and things of that nature, then she came out publicly and said that she could no longer be a Republican. She's changing to become a Democrat. Now, she served as the 67th United States Secretary of State from 2009 to 2013, and she was the junior United States Senator representing the state of New York from 2001 to 2009. She was First Lady of the United States during the presidency of her husband, Bill Clinton, from 1993 to 2001. And she was the First Lady of Arkansas during President Clinton's governorship in Arkansas from 1979 to 1981. And then he lost the next election and came back, ran again, where he won. And that was from 1983 to 1992. So he served, Clinton served as governor two separate terms with a break in between them. Hillary was born in Chicago, raised in a suburban town of Park Ridge, Illinois. She attended Wellesley College, graduating in 1969, and earned a JD from Yale Law School in 1973. After serving as a congressional legal counsel, she moved to Arkansas, marrying Bill Clinton in 1975. And then in 1977, she co-founded the Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. She was appointed the first female chair of the Legal Services Corporation in 1978. And the following year, she became the first woman partner of the Rose Law Firm, a very prestigious law firm. As First Lady of Arkansas, she led a task force whose recommendations helped reform Arkansas public schools, and she served on several corporate boards and so on and so forth. Now, as First Lady of the United States, Clinton led the unsuccessful effort to enact the Clinton Health Care Plan in 1993. It was an unsuccessful effort, but she fought hard for that. In 1997 and 1999, she helped create the state children's health insurance program, which was a successful effort. A lot of kids are insured under that program right now. She also tackled the problems of adoption and family safety and the foster care system. At the 1995 UN Conference on Women held in Beijing, she stated in a controversial statement, it was a very influential speech that she made, and she said, human rights are women's rights, and women's rights are human rights. So that really launched her career to a higher level, taking on the women's rights issue, equal pay for women, and a whole lot of other issues as well. Now, there's a lot more. But that's a summary of Hillary Clinton. I mean, obviously, she's been in the public eye for 30-some years, so there's a lot more. There's no time to go through everything that she's done. I want to touch on Donald Trump, who was born June 14, 1946. So she's about a year older than Hillary. He's an American businessman, television producer, author, politician. And he's the Republican nominee for president of the United States. And he's a chairman and president of Trump, the Trump Organization, which is the principal holding company for his real estate ventures and quite a few other business interests as well. During his career, Trump was he's built a lot of office towers, hotels, casinos, golf courses, he's known for an urban development project in Manhattan and other branded facilities worldwide. He was born and raised in Queens, New York, the borough of Queens in New York City. He received a bachelor's degree in economics from the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania in 1968. While attending college, he worked in his father's real estate construction firm. His father's name was Fred Trump, for those older folks who might remember him. And Donald Trump was given control of the business in 1971, and it was later renamed the Trump Organization. Trump has made a lot of cameo appearances in a lot of films and television series. He also appeared on the Miss USA pageant quite a few times, or quite often, actually. He actually owned the Miss USA pageant from 1996 to 2015. And he actually ran for president before. A lot of people don't know that. He sought the nomination by the Reform Party. You know, we have the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, the Green Party, the Coffee Party. You have all these different parties. He actually ran once for the nominee of the Reform Party. And then, of course, we know about his TV show, The Apprentice. He's actually listed as one of the Forbes' top 500 billionaires. Can you imagine that? There are over 500 billionaires in the world, and he's listed in the top 500 of them. Wow. So anyway, those are your two candidates. And there is a lot of information out there on both of these candidates, theories and all sorts of things out there. So let's begin with, because it's going on 7 o'clock here. We've got about 30 minutes left. And feel free to dial number one. I see we got a lot of people out there listening to the show. If you got any questions, comments, concerns, dial the number one and we'll bring you on the air. But I want to touch on some of the issues and things that hopefully you guys care about, and just so you understand where these candidates stand. Let's talk about the economy. A lot of people concerned about the economy. And Hillary Clinton is basically running on a revised version of Barack Obama's philosophy as far as running the economy. And Donald Trump is anti-Obama as far as his policy on running the economy, or as far as anything else for that matter. So basically what Hillary Clinton is running on is as follows, for as far as the economy goes. Hillary Clinton is for raising the minimum wage. Okay, the argument is that if you, one of the arguments against Obama's economy is that wages have gone up very little over the last 8 years. And one of the arguments is that, the reason wages haven't gone up, one of the reasons is because Republicans have blocked every single attempt that Obama has made to increase the minimum wage. And Clinton's argument is that if you increase the minimum wage, then that will increase consumer spending. Consumer spending being three-quarters of the gross national product. The United States is fueled by spending. And if you give consumers more money to spend, then they'll go to the store and spend it. And when they spend that money, then the retailers make money, and so that the retailers can then order more products, so that the truckers deliver those products, and the wholesalers can make money, and the manufacturers can start making more products. And if the manufacturers are making more products, they need to hire more people to make them. And the more people that they hire to make them, the more people have money, and the more people have money, the more money they have to spend and go to the store and spend. So it creates a vicious circle going in the right direction. People spending, retailers making money,
Orders increasing for the manufacturers hiring more people to respond to those orders, and then the more people they hire, the more money there is for people to spend creating that circle. Now, the argument against increasing the minimum wage is that the biggest expense that any employer has are the wages it pays its employees. So when you raise the minimum wage, the argument is that you're crippling the employers, which will cost them tons of money, and in the end will result in them laying people off because, hey, if they've got to pay people more money, we're just going to lay some of them off to save that money. That's the argument. It's not an argument I buy because you won't have to lay people off if people have more money to spend, because you'll need more people to keep up with the demand. It's a supply and demand type of thing. The more money people have to spend, the bigger demand there is for products and services, and the bigger the demand is for products and services, the more products and services you need, and therefore you need more people. And the more products and services you sell, the more money you're making as a business. So that's why I don't buy that argument. You can make up your own opinion, but those are two sides of the argument. So Clinton is for raising the minimum wage. Donald Trump is against raising the minimum wage. So if you are working in certain and one thing that I should point out about raising the minimum wage is the impact on people who make more than minimum wage, because a lot of people feel that, hey, I already, you know, minimum wage is $7-$8 an hour or whatever. I already make $12 an hour, so raising the minimum wage is not going to help me. Well, if what happens is the reason you're getting $12 an hour is because that company has decided that they want a higher quality. Because let's face it, to some extent, the more money you pay, the higher quality of the people you can attract. So they've decided that they wanted to attract a higher quality candidate as an employee, so they're going to pay a wage that's higher than the minimum wage. Now, if the minimum wage is raised to $12 an hour, then that company is no longer paying a wage that's higher than the minimum wage, and therefore they're not going to get that higher quality candidate that they're seeking. So the only way to get that higher quality candidate they're seeking would be to raise your pay above the current minimum wage, if that makes sense to anybody. So raising the minimum wage will tend to push up everyone else's wage who is currently earning more than that now. The pressure will be to push all wages up. And that's what Republicans argue will eventually start crippling the businesses. And the Democrats argue that, no, it will increase consumer spending, which will increase business profitability in the long run. So that's the argument. So if you are in favor of an increase in the minimum wage, so far you want to look at voting for Hillary Clinton. If you are against the minimum wage being higher, you want or being higher than so far, you should be leaning toward Trump. The second thing that Hillary Clinton is looking to do is she is looking to cut taxes on people who make a lot of money. I believe the figure it's over $1 million, or excuse me, over $250,000. I'm sorry. There are two types of taxes she wants to raise. One would be on people over over $1 million, and another tax for making over $250,000. So let's be clear. Trump will always say, you can hear him say on every speech, that Hillary Clinton wants to raise your taxes. She is not. And these are facts. She is not proposing to raise taxes on the lower and middle class. She is looking to raise taxes on the top 1%
of the earners in this United States, people who make over $250,000 and over $1 million. And her theory is that right now, you know, those people in those tax brackets have so many loopholes and things of that nature that they're not paying their fair share of taxes. They have most of the money, but they actually pay almost no taxes, and the tax burden is on the lower and middle classes. So what Hillary is proposing is to raise taxes on the rich, close some of those loopholes, those tax loopholes for the rich, so that they pay more of their fair share of taxes, and then she is proposing a modest tax cut for the middle class. So the argument that she wants to raise taxes is not all the way true. She's looking to raise taxes on the rich and close some of the loopholes so that they pay their fair share of taxes. And then she's actually proposing a tax cut for the middle class. That's the fact. Donald Trump is proposing a huge tax cut across the board. He wants to cut taxes way more than Hillary Clinton for the middle class, and huge tax cuts for the rich and the wealthy. His argument is that if you cut taxes for the wealthy, then the money that they save on taxes will trickle down to the middle class and the poor, because that money that they save, they will take it and invest with it. They will expand. They will buy more equipment. They'll hire more people, and so on and so forth. The argument against that is, from the Democrat side, or what Hillary argues is, that's called trickle-down economics, the idea that the more money the rich make, it'll somehow trickle down to the poor because they'll spend it investing and creating jobs for the middle class and the poor. But the argument is that that has never actually been proven to be true. A lot of times if you save the rich money, all they do is put it in their pocket. Fact is, and this is a fact, the wealthy save much more money than the poor and the middle class. Why? One of the reasons is because they've got more money to save, obviously. But the other argument is, frankly, rich people are smarter about how they handle money. That's why they're rich. So they understand the power of saving money. So give them a tax cut, there's no guarantee that they're going to invest, especially if there's no demand. So Trump's argument is, the demand will be created by the tax cut that he's offering the middle class. So that'll effectively give the middle class more money to spend, increasing consumer spending, and then the rich will have, when they see that demand increase, then they will have money to invest, build, and so on and so forth, which will create more jobs and so on and so forth. That's the Republican argument. The Democratic argument, Hillary's argument, is that we've got going on, you know, a $20 trillion deficit right now, or debt. Sorry, not deficit. A $20 trillion debt is what we're going to have here pretty soon. And cutting taxes as much as he wants to, both in the middle class and from the rich, is not going to help the government pay that debt. It's going to hurt the government's ability to pay that debt, so that the debt's just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, for one. Number two, that, again, saving the rich money has never proven to trickle down necessarily to the middle class and the poor. Or at least very little of it, it usually does. They usually just stick those savings in their pocket. Every time the Republicans give the rich a tax cut, they don't go out and spend the money. They put a lot of it in their pocket. That's the argument. Those are the arguments from Republicans, I mean, from the Democrats, is, you know, hey, that money is probably not going to trickle down. And number two, how can you pay off this national debt if you're going to cut taxes so severely? And then the rebuttal from Trump is that, hey, the economic growth that will be sparked by these tax cuts on the rich and the middle class will increase the tax base enough for us to pay down the debt. Now, the economists have all come together and they've looked at both tax plans, the Republicans or Hillary Clinton's and Trump's, and they're saying that Trump's plan is likely to increase the national debt by $7.2 trillion. $7.2 trillion. That's what economists are saying. That's not, and I'm not picking and choosing economists. These are economists across the board. Republicans and Democrats are saying that that's likely what's going to happen. The only way it wouldn't happen is if Trump's theory is correct, that the tax, the economic growth that's sparked by those huge tax cuts is so big that it really does increase the tax base enough to cover the losses from cutting the taxes. But the argument is that there's no guarantee that that will happen because there are a lot of things that affects our economy that are out of our control. What if the rest of the world has a recession? Then you just cut all the taxes, and this is a exporting country. The United States is an exporting country. So if the world has a world recession, our exports go down. That growth never occurs, but yet you just cut all the tax base away. So it's a huge risk and a huge gamble. This is what economists are saying. And most economists are saying that they don't think it's a gamble worth taking because the end result is possibly to be an increase of the national debt by $7.2 trillion due to reducing the tax base by cutting taxes so much. What they're saying about Hillary's proposal is that the likelihood is that no impact, there will be absolutely no impact to the debt at all. In other words, her proposal will not decrease the national debt. It won't increase it either. And the reason is that the mild tax cut that she's promoting for the middle class will be offset by the large tax increase on the rich, thereby canceling each other out. But the end result will be that the middle class will receive a mild tax cut, which will help them put more money into the middle class pockets and increase consumer spending a little. So that'll be a little bit of a boost to the economy from her tax proposal, but no impact to the national debt. Now, Hillary proposes other things to decrease the national debt, and Trump does too. But I don't know if we're going to have time to get into all that or not. I want to stick with some of the big big ideas. Now, let's move to social justice, because that is, I know, a big thing, especially among minorities. I guess in order to talk about that, you have to talk about what the campaign slogans are. Donald Trump's campaign slogan is Make America Great Again. Hillary Clinton's campaign slogan is Stronger Together. Let's just look at the let's dissect what the campaign slogans are actually saying. And this is just opinion here. I said I want to differentiate between opinion and fact.
This is my opinion I'm going to state. When I look at the campaign slogan, Make America Great Again, I start to question what part in American history are you calling so great? You know, was it the time that all the Indians and Native Americans were slaughtered and all their land was taken from them? You know, was it that time, great time in America? Was it the time when black people were slaves or serfs? Or was it the time that we rounded up all the Japanese Americans and put them in camps? Was that the great time in American history that Trump is talking about? Was it the time when black people swung from random trees? Was that great time in American history during the 50s when black people were being hosed down in the streets, dogs sicked on them just for, you know, exercising their right to protest? Or that great time when black churches were being bombed in the early 60s, that time when we weren't allowed to vote or eat in public restaurants, we had to go into the back door of hotels? And was it that great time in America, or that great time during the 70s when we were being discriminated against for housing and loans and business loans? Or that great time, and you know, when we had all that predatory lending? So what great time in American history are you talking about? When I look back at American history, it seems to me that for at least black people and other minorities, now is a greater time than ever. And throughout American history, the United States has never been all that great for anybody but Caucasians. Now, I'm not saying that as a matter of racism or prejudice or anything of that matter. It's just a matter of observation that throughout U.S. history, times haven't been all that great for black people and minorities. So when you say you want to go back to that great time of the past, it seems like you want to go back to a time when things were absolutely great for Caucasians but weren't all that great for anybody else. So I can't buy into that campaign slogan, let's make America great. You know, it seems to me to think right now things are greater for blacks and minorities than they ever been in American history. Not that things don't need to improve now. Not that things are all that wonderful now, but certainly better now than they ever have been in the past. So why go backwards? Let's move forward. Now, let's look at Hillary Clinton's campaign slogan, which is Stronger Together. Now, when I listen to that campaign slogan, and some people will disagree with me because there are people out there who believe that separation is best, you know, and people who support Trump mostly, and a lot of black folks who believe that separation. I disagree. I believe we're stronger together. Division has never been a strength, led to a powerful union. Whenever your house is divided, it tends to be weaker than it is when it is unified. Division has never led to power. What's divided is usually weak. And one side, it always seems to lead to mistrust, because one side is always wondering what the other side is conspiring against them. What are they doing over there? You know, that's why I'm against building a wall between us and Mexico, our good friends forever. Now we're going to build a wall. When have walls ever led to anything good throughout U.S. history? It has always led to mistrust and war, because pretty soon people start wondering, hey, what are they doing over there? Why would they build a wall in the first place? You know, they don't like us. You know, they're over there conspiring against us. You know, we need to start building up our military in case they attack us. And then the other side sees that you're building your military, so they say we better build ours because they're over there conspiring something against us. This is the type of thing that division causes. So I like the concept of stronger together, because what anything that we need to do in this nation is going to take unity of the people to get it done. No one people in this nation, I believe, has the power to do anything by itself. You know, even black people who claim, hey, we need to have our own communities and we need to recirculate our wealth within our own community more. I agree. But the idea that you can solely do that by yourself is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, because you still will have to deal with, in order to get the best pricing on your goods and services that you're going to sell each other, you're going to have to go to the rich and powerful companies that are run by white people, you know. And then you have to abide by the rules and regulations of the system that you have to operate within. Nobody's going to allow you to have your own system. You got to work on this system, under the system that we have, the economic system and governmental system. You're going to have to get you have to follow the rules, the regulations. You got to pay taxes. You got to get whatever zoning requirements that you need. You got to get whatever permits that you need, whatever licenses that you need to run your business. And anytime you do any of that, you're going to have to deal with white people. So this idea of separation is kind of a farce. And, you know, I'm not saying that it doesn't make sense for certain communities to, like black communities or whatever, to try to recirculate their money more within their own community. That's the American way, actually. So I have no problem with that, but the idea that you can never deal with, you've got to separate or going to be able to separate yourself completely from Caucasian America is ridiculous. So stronger together is a campaign slogan that I, for one, can buy into. That's my opinion. So when we start talking about social justice, it seems to me that Hillary's campaign is already moving a little bit more towards social justice, in my opinion, just from the slogan. And Trump's campaign slogan of going back to a time when social justice was horrible seems to be going in the wrong direction, just from the campaign slogan. One thing that Trump supports, he just recently said, he wants more law and order. Now, nobody's against law and order, but it's the way he said it on the debate. He said, we need more law and order. And then he followed up by saying that he wants to return to the policy of stop and frisk, a policy no black person likes, you know. So Hillary Clinton is against that, and she says that the policy of stop and frisk, all that does is lead to racial profiling and fuels mass incarceration. I agree. But these are the policies of these candidates. You know, Trump says he wants stop and frisk. Hillary Clinton is against it, saying that it fuels mass incarceration, racial profiling, and all of that. So one of the arguments against Hillary Clinton is that her husband, Bill Clinton, signed the I'll think of the name of the law in just a moment here. I'm having a brain fart. What happened was Bill Clinton signed a law into office that did a lot of different things. One of the things it did was it created a lot of tough laws that require police to go after drug dealers and drug users. because the idea back at the time, and let me put some context behind this. Bill Clinton was the first president who ever had a national town hall meeting for black folks. It was held at the University of Akron, and it was televised nationwide, prime time, first time anything like that had ever been done. He took a lot of heat for it. Everybody said, "Don't do this, Mr. Clinton. It'll be political suicide." He said, "No, I got it." So I had a lot of respect for him for doing it because it was not politically advantageous for him to do so. And he did it. And I remember watching it, and I remember all of the black folks surrounding Bill Clinton in this hall at the University of Akron, and each one of them, one after another, standing up and beating down on Bill Clinton, saying that they wanted the drugs off of their streets and that they wanted the violence, the gang violence, stopped. And demanding that the president do something about the gang violence and drugs on the streets. So Bill Clinton went back to Washington and did something about it. And he signed into law, I'm going to try to look it up. Again, my computer is moving at a ridiculous pace. But the law he signed into effect, what it did was, or what resulted, was a lot of additional stops by police. You know, the police was stopping everybody on the streets and frisking them and trying to find drugs. A lot of drugs were being found, too. And when they found drugs, they put them in jail. But what resulted was a lot of racial profiling because the drug communities just so happened to always have been black communities. And so the police just started focusing on those black communities and going in there and, you know, just riding around randomly, stopping people. Then we frisk you. And if anything was wrong, they took you to jail. So this is what started going on. And now a lot of black people, they're upset about this law. But at the time that Clinton signed the law, it sounded great to everybody. It sounded great to me. Yeah, get the druggies off the street. Heck yeah, lock them up. Lock them gangbangers up because they're out here shooting and killing people and random bullets hitting kids. And, you know, makes a lot of sense. Lock them up. But as time went by, the unintentional result was the racial profiling that led to fueling mass incarceration, and a lot of people blame Bill Clinton for that. And he took responsibility for it. He has said that that's one regret that he has about that law. And Hillary says the same thing. But it's important to look at the rest of that law because there are a lot of good things that happen in that law as well. It was the first law that put forth a lot of money for body cameras on the police officers. It was the first law put a lot of money into the prison system for education so that you could go to college while you were in prison, you know, get an associate's degree, bachelor's degree, master's degree, or what have you, vocations in the prisons and stuff like that. There was a lot of money for reducing recidivism and retraining people once they got out of prison so that they could get meaningful employment. So that they didn't, you know, they were less likely to go back to the life that they used to have. So there were a lot of good things in that law, but the one bad thing that came out of it was that it did help fuel mass incarceration. So bad mark on the Hillary legacy. But at the same time, I applaud the fact that they were trying to, I believe, do something for black people because there were a lot of things in the law that actually did help black people. And it was black people who demanded that the law be put into place in the first place because we all thought it was a good idea. And then also, when we look at Hillary Clinton's past, there are a lot of things that she has done. Now, we're running out of time. So we have such a wonderful guest the first half of the show that
you know, it ran over. I just had to talk to her because her story was just so incredible to me. So we gave her so much time that we didn't get to get very far in this political discussion. So I'm just going to break it on down into an opinion before it's all over. Number one, you need to vote. Your vote does count. Get out there and vote. Who do you vote for? In my humble opinion, you vote for Hillary Clinton. I don't care if you're a Republican or Democrat or whatever, Donald Trump is not qualified to be president of the United States. He has never been a politician. And I know there are a lot of people out there who feel that that's what we need is somebody who's not a politician. No. You need a politician. But political science is, you can get a degree in political science. Politics is a career field. It is a skill. You need to have on a high level in order to be able to be a politician, because if you hire someone who's never been a politician to be the nation's lead politician, it doesn't make sense to put someone with absolutely no experience into that position. The presidency of the United States is a position where you have to be a qualified politician. I need people to understand that. Okay? You can't say anything that comes out of your mouth. You are a world leader. The definition of the word leader is someone who people follow. And when you say things, people follow your lead. So when you're president of the United States, you can't say, hey, I would bomb somebody if it was me, because then the people around the world say, hey, you heard the United States, we should bomb them. And people start following your lead. You can't insult the president of a country and tell them what you're going to make them do, because they're going to say, you can't make me do anything. That's what the president of Mexico said when Donald Trump said that we're going to build a wall and make Mexico pay for it. And then the president of Mexico said, we're not paying for shit. Excuse my language. I'm not paying for a damn thing. You can't make me. You know, so then what do? You're going to go to war with him? You know, so, you know, these types of ridiculous things, he's saying that, hey, Japan needs to have nuclear weapons, and Japan doesn't want to have nuclear weapons, you know. And so now China's like, uh-oh, Japan might get nuclear weapons, because if Trump is elected president, he's going to try to get Japan to have nuclear weapons. So we need to build up our nuclear force even more. You see how that works? You can't say anything as president. You can't do anything. The president of the United States is also what's called the head of state. The term head of state means that this is the person who represents our nation around the world. So when you have someone representing your country who is being accused of groping 9 different women, whether he did it or not is besides the point. The accusations of these types of accusations against someone who's holding the office of president of the United States, who the heck wants a president who has that type of a reputation? And it's a believable reputation because of he got caught on tape saying that he does what he's been accused of doing. So, you know, vote for Hillary Clinton because she has the temperament and the experience to be president. You may not trust her, the truth of the matter is she hasn't done that much that's untrustworthy. The email scandal, so she used a different server. So she used her own server. So what? It boggles me how people want to turn her into a traitor to the United States because she decided to use her own email service. I'm sure that it wasn't her intent to be a traitor to the United States and to give away American secrets. I'm sure she wouldn't do it again. She knows better now. She did it. She made a mistake. It was an error in judgment. But who the heck wants a president who has never had an error in judgment? Errors in judgment create experience. You know, that's how you get experience. You make mistakes, and then you say, okay, I'm not going to make that mistake again, or I'm not going to make a similar mistake again.
So this is Hillary has been in politics for over 30 years. She's made her share of mistakes, and each one of them is what has led to her being the most experienced candidate for the president of the United States ever in the history of this nation. So why would you not vote for her and vote for one Donald Trump? Okay, that's my opinion, and I'm going to stand by it. Get out and vote, everybody. This has been Let's Change the World. And remember, any little random act of kindness that you do has a ripple effect around the world. So when you smile at somebody, you cause them to smile, they feel better and go do something nice for somebody else who does something nice for somebody else. Let's keep it going. This has been Let's Change the World. Until next time.
Start the clock. Good afternoon.